What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Hey everybody, welcome to the show. My name is Charlie Robinson. You can find information about my book and this podcast at theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Mowefus, M-O-W-E-F-U-S. You can follow me on Facebook at Facebook/theoctopusofglobalcontrol. And today we are going to talk about the psychosis of government. It's an interesting thing because government has always been here as far as we're concerned in our lifetime. It's as normal as, you know, getting up, brushing your teeth and going to work. But the truth of the matter is that government is unnecessary, and we've been brainwashed into thinking that it is, not only is it necessary, but the without it, we would not be able to function. We would, you know, life would end as we know it. And it's really just not even close to being the case. You don't need government to tell you how to behave. You don't need government to tell you what's right and what's wrong. I understand there's sets of laws and things like that that try to shape behavior, but the source of it, the government itself, is so dirty. You know, it's so infested with people that are reprehensible and grifters and scumbags and psychopaths. It's just a mess of a place. And in keeping with the format of my book, I brought in quotes from 500 different people that had had a role in these important events, and they or people that see things from a different angle. I think the best way to start this episode off is to read Paul Craig Roberts. He was the former Assistant Secretary of Treasury under Ronald Reagan, and if you've watched any YouTube videos with him, he's phenomenal. He's an older guy, but he's just got a way about him. You could tell he is just fed up. He has almost zero tolerance for bullshit at this point, which I really like about him. But he says this: Americans need to understand that they have lost their country. The rest of the world needs to recognize that Washington is not merely the most complete police state since Stalinism, but also a threat to the entire world. The hubris and arrogance of Washington, combined with Washington's huge supply of weapons of mass destruction, make Washington the greatest threat that has ever existed to all life on this planet. Washington is the enemy of all humanity. Boy, you know, I can't argue with that. It's tough to make a case that that's not true. They're always lecturing, you know, what the thing about Washington, I think, that makes people so frustrated is just the utter hypocrisy that comes from them. It doesn't matter who you're dealing with. It doesn't matter if you're on the red team or the blue team. They're all on the purple team, right? It's just a mix between the two of them. They're all going and playing golf together. They're all going to the same parties. They're all going to Jeffrey Epstein's island together. I mean, this sort of fabrication that there's a red side and a blue side, and that they're constantly at war, and one stands for this and the other stands for that, and they don't like each other. That's all theater, man. It's just not even, it's not even true. You know, we used to see John Boehner out on the golf course, and, you know, Bighorn in Palm Desert. He's out there with a bunch of guys from across the aisle, you know? They're not fighting. They're buddies. They're all on the same team. They're on the Koch brothers team. That's who's team they're on. They're on the green team. They're on the money team. And so this illusion of separation and this illusion of division. I mean, does Nancy Pelosi hate Donald Trump? Yeah, I think she probably does. I think a lot of people, you know, don't like her. I'll tell you what, I don't care for her. Here's a quote from her. This pretty much sums up Nancy Pelosi. But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what's in it, away from the fog of the controversy. This is Nancy Pelosi attempting to justify passing Obama's health care law in 2010, a law that she did not even bother to read. And she is encouraging everyone in Congress to pass the bill first, then read it afterwards. I mean, this is just insanity. Nancy, here's a burrito. Eat the whole thing. Once you're done, I'll tell you what I put in it. I mean, it's as preposterous as that. But this is deemed normal in Washington, D.C. It's normal to do things like this, to stack a 1,400-page bill, and it's written by lobbyists. You have 12 hours to read it. And they got a gun to your head saying you have to pass it right now. Why? Why? Because you don't want the people to read it, to see what's in it. Why would you not want them to read it? Because if they read it, they wouldn't pass it. Well, why wouldn't they pass it? Because it's a shitty deal. Written by lobbyists, of course. So why do we accept this? Why do we accept this philosophy that we're just supposed to trust these people and just let them do what they need to do, and pass bills that they don't read? Who decided that this is normal? It's not normal. You wouldn't accept this in your real life. You wouldn't allow, you wouldn't tolerate your spouse doing things like this to you. This is psychotic. It's totally backwards. But this is the mentality of Washington. And nobody, in my opinion, nobody sums up the mentality of Washington in a smart and funny way quite like Matt Taibbi, the writer for Rolling Stone. He's written plenty of books. He has his own podcast called Useful Idiots with Katie Halper. It's fantastic. He's doing great work. And he said this: Washington politicians basically view the people as a capricious and dangerous enemy, a dumb mob whose only interesting quality happens to be their power to take away politicians' jobs. When the government sees its people as the enemy, sooner or later, that feeling gets to be mutual. And that's when the real weirdness begins. I would say that the feeling has been mutual for quite some time now, that people do not have much respect for politicians, and it's not for nothing, right? They give you plenty of reasons to despise what they're doing. They constantly lie to us. They pretend to not prioritize their loyalty towards corporations and donors. But that's where their interests lie. That's who puts them in office financially, gives them the ability to run for office. And then they spend their entire career not trying to fix Washington, not trying to solve these problems, but trying to just stay in power. So they're constantly raising more money for this new campaign that they're going to have to participate in a couple of years to keep their jobs. It's a very weird dynamic. It's a very unhealthy dynamic. The fact that people can, like Joe Biden, can work in politics for 40 years and never have a real job, and then he's somehow going to represent the people. How would he know what the people want? He's not a person. He's a politician. It's like a different class. He might even be a reptile. What do we know? He's certainly a weirdo with his hairy legs and corn pop and all that nonsense. But you get a guy 40 years in politics and you ask him to understand what you're going through. It's like pulling a guy 40 years in Pelican Bay and asking him to understand what you're going through. He can't. His environment is different. The things that are valuable in prison or things that are valuable in Washington, D.C., are not the same things that are valuable to middle America. You know, they don't have the same values. They don't have the same priorities. It's a weird cesspit of corruption and money and power, and it tarnishes everything. The politicians get in the way, they screw up the world, and they do it while waving little flags, right? To show that they are patriotic about their country and that they're the cheerleaders for it. Oliver Stone had a good quote. He said, "Nationalism and patriotism are the two most evil forces that I know of in this century or in any century, and cause more wars and more death and more destruction to the soul and to human life than anything else." He's right. How many, and he's a guy that was in Vietnam, right? So he understands a little bit about being manipulated to go to war to fight imaginary enemies that haven't done anything to you. I mean, it all gets thrown out the window once the shots start coming your way. Then you're just fighting for your buddies to your left and right and fighting to go home. But the lead up to these wars that are fueled by these politicians are never really anchored in truth. With regard to Vietnam, you have the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which is where allegedly a North Vietnamese PT boat was shooting at an American boat, and that kicked off the Vietnamese conflict. Well, that never happened. I don't mean in a sense like, oh, it happened a little differently than that. No, it didn't happen. There was no North Vietnamese boat that was firing at the American boat. It was a non-event. It was manufactured. And yet it kicked off a war because of that, which is insanity. You know, if you don't appreciate or not enthusiastic enough about a war, you're branded as being unpatriotic. Never mind the fact that the war is always something totally contrived. They will actively hunt you down to demonize you for being anti-war. Just look at what the Dixie Chicks said. They said they were embarrassed that George W. Bush was from their state. It was actually quite an innocuous comment. It ended their careers for the most part because of that. People were protesting them. How dare they do that? How dare they come out and this America, man. You know, love it or leave it, you stupid bitches. You can get out of here. Well, what? They were right. How about where's the apology for the Dixie Chicks, huh? For being right. Chris Hedges tells an interesting story. You talk about going back to Vietnam a little bit. Chris Hedges talks about, he's talking about Henry Kissinger. And, you know, boy, poster child for American presidential integrity right there, right? Kissinger and Nixon. He says, in Kissinger's memoirs, 1971, huge anti-war demonstrations surrounding the White House, and Nixon has put empty buses, city buses, end to end as a kind of barricade, and he's standing at the window, wringing his hands, going, "Henry," meaning Henry Kissinger, "Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us." And that's just where you want people in power to be. And Chris Hedges is right. Chris Hedges, by the way, is one of the greatest writers of our time. And if you've ever watched any of his talks, the dude can go for an hour and a half with no notes and just write it, you know, because he's been there. He's been in Bosnia, in those wars, covering those wars, covering the Middle East for two decades. So he understands what it's about. He, you know, and he's right. You want people in power to fear making huge mistakes. And frankly, the people in power right now do not have that fear. They do not, you know, if they did, you would certainly see a little bit more respect from the politicians towards the people. But currently, the way it's set up, they don't give a shit about us. They really don't. And Larkin Rose, who's an anarchist and an activist and a good dude, he wrote Politics. He described it like this: Politics, the art of using euphemisms, lies, emotionalism, and fear-mongering to dupe average people into accepting or even demanding their own enslavement. That's what it is. That's what it is. This, you know, the American politicians have abused the trust of their own people and squandered, you know, any sort of goodwill they might have had based on their actions. It is, you know, it at its core, government is wrong, but the politicians have made it easy to hate the government system because you see them behaving as if everything is normal, when in actuality, everything is backwards. The things that that they're pushing, the agendas that they're pushing, they don't benefit us. I mean, they're not for the people. They're supposed to represent the people, yet they go to Washington, and who do they you know, who do their decisions wind up benefiting? Well, they benefit the people that give them money, the corporations, you know, the super PACs, the Citizens United that allows unlimited corporate campaign money to come flowing in. And then we act surprised that they don't have our backs. Well, of course they don't have our backs. We didn't pay them, you know? We didn't support them financially. The corporations did. So who do you think they're going to represent? They're going to represent the corporations. Of course, it's the wrong way to behave, but we shouldn't act really all that surprised. And Larkin Rose finishes this up. He says, the truth is that any form of authoritarian control, any type of government, whether constitutional, democratic, socialist, fascist, or anything else, will result in a set of masters forcibly oppressing a group of slaves. That is what authority is. All it has ever been, all it can ever be, no matter how many layers of euphemisms and pleasant rhetoric are used in any attempt to hide it. He's right. Part of what happens when you spend a decent amount of time in Washington, D.C. working is that it starts to mess with your version of reality. You wind up believing things that are counter to the way the world really works because you're surrounded by so many people that are sociopathic, and the way Washington works is actually not the same way that the rest of the country works. So it's understandable that you can get a warped idea of reality by spending a lot of time in Washington, D.C. But some people are more detached than others. And if you remember John Ashcroft, he was the former attorney general. He was involved. He was knee deep in it with 9/11 and everything around that time frame. But I want to read you what he said, and I'm going to read it twice because the first time I read it, you're going to think that there's some mistake, that there's some typo or something. That is most definitely not the case. So let me just read what he said. I feel the best way to ensure Americans' freedom is to tighten restrictions on that freedom in any way possible. Only through wiretaps, illegal searches and seizures, unfettered government intrusion, a controlled media, and a complete crackdown on free speech can we ensure the liberties of all people. Okay, I'm going to read it a second time. Listen to the words. I feel that the best way to ensure Americans' freedom is to tighten restrictions on that freedom in any way possible. Only through wiretaps, illegal searches and seizures, unfettered government intrusion, a controlled media, and a complete crackdown on free speech, can we ensure the liberties of all people? I don't even know how to interpret that in any way that makes actual sense. I don't know if he was smoking PCP before he said this, or had a gun to his head and was forced to read this statement. I have no idea, because I'm having a hard time putting this together in a way that makes sense, that the best way to ensure freedoms is to restrict freedoms. The best way to ensure free speech and liberty is to crack down on free speech and control the media. But this is Washington, D.C. This is the psychosis of politics. This is why you get things like Richard Nixon saying, when the president does it, that means that it's not illegal. No, it doesn't. That is not true. Actually, when the president does it, it's still illegal, but nobody's going to do anything about it because the government is corrupt beyond repair. Now, one place where we saw massive corruption, and you didn't have to be a fan of government or a conspiracy theorist or somebody that's studies wars or anything like that. But one place that was just unbelievably obvious and blatant about government corruption and the psychotic nature of the people in positions of power was the rebuilding of Iraq after the second Gulf War. With Dick Cheney and Halliburton. So Dick Cheney used to be the CEO of Halliburton, and Halliburton is a multinational engineering firm. It's like Bechtel or companies like that. They build, they don't build houses for you. You know, they build large, they build power plants, they build dams, they build runways for, they build airports, they build big things. They're a gigantic construction company. So Cheney ran, what was called the Energy Task Force, and they gave tens of billions of dollars in tax breaks and subsidies to oil companies while he was the vice president. And KBR, which is Kellogg Brown and Root, it's a subsidiary of Halliburton, they received $39.5 billion in no-bid contracts to rebuild Iraq. You remember Iraq, right? That place really, really far away that Dick Cheney decided that we needed to invade because of 9/11 or something, or yellowcake uranium, or I'm not really sure. You know, that place that we decided to just level and destroy. His buddies all put it back together, and he gave them no-bid contracts, and they didn't do a very good job of it. But from 2001 to 2003, Halliburton's government contracts increased ninefold, from $400 million to $3.9 billion, thanks to Dick Cheney. He stepped down as CEO to run as W's vice president, won the election, and then went about basically just handing all of this money right out the back door to Halliburton. Said that he had, put his stocks in a blind trust and blah, blah, blah. Can't trade on his stocks and all this. Who knows? Who cares? I mean, that doesn't matter. He was involved in giving these no bid contracts to literally the company that he just left to go become the vice president. I mean, if there aren't rules in place to prevent that, then what are we doing here? You know, really, we're no better than, a third world country, you know, or some crazy dictator out in the jungle. This is the Wild West when you're just giving away money like that to your friends. But because it's wartime, and because Dick Cheney is Darth Vader and everybody was terrified of him, nobody challenged him on it. He just went ahead and did it with almost no no repercussions. You know, they gave all this money to go rebuild Afghanistan. What did that take? An afternoon? They were living in the Bronze Age on September 10th, 2001. After September 11th, 2001, we bombed them back to the Stone Age. Well, how long did it take Halliburton to build? Would they have to build back a bunch of yurts and caves and mud huts and things? I mean, what the fuck were they doing out there? Well, I'll tell you what they were doing. They were collecting free money and doing nothing with it, at least in Afghanistan. But, when it came to Iraq, though, that's a different story. So they had a situation in Iraq where KBR was building all of these military bases for the troops. And it came out that it says a Navy captain admits that the Army should have known the extent of the severity of the electrical problems. The email then says the reason the Army did not know was because KBR's inspections were never reviewed by a qualified government employee. So what are we talking about here? KBR was building all of these bases for the troops, and they were having electrical problems. You know, electricity, it's been around for 100 years. KBR, Halliburton, these are multinational engineering firms. They should know a little bit of something about electricity, right? They should know how it works. They should be able to figure out how to build showers, and they should be able to figure out how to build buildings. Oh, no. Because apparently when it comes to building things that actually matter, they throw the blueprints away or they just forget it or whatever. It turns out that 18 soldiers were killed by being electrocuted in showers that were built by KBR. 18 people, 18 U.S. troops died in showers built by KBR. They weren't walking in there with toaster ovens. They weren't going Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and asking them to chuck a record player in the bathtub with them, you know, when White Rabbit starts. I mean, they're showers. Troops are taking showers and electrocuting themselves and dying in there. Not one, not two, not half a dozen, 18 of them. I mean, who was running the plumbing division at KBR? Heinrich Himmler? They were giving a Treblinka showers a run for their money with this. This is what you get. This is what you get when you have no checks and balances because government is running the show and they're just throwing money at problems without actually getting to the core of the problems. And in this case, there was no oversight. There was no plan. It was how can we take all this money and spend as little of it on actual projects as we can and put the rest in our pocket. That was the strategy here. And if 18 US soldiers have to die in Iraq from shower related deaths, well then who cares, right? Because we've got a couple $1 billion in profits and Dick Cheney's stock doubled, right? And that's all that matters in the end. And here's Keith Olbermann's take on this. You can say what you want about Keith Olbermann. He was great on SportsCenter. Kind of went off the rails towards the end. But the Pentagon document now indicates that these Dick Cheney electrocution showers were installed virtually everywhere. 94 American troops in Iraq and Afghanistan or other CENTCOM facilities with KBR showers sought medical treatment for electric shock. KBR's own database lists a total of 231 electrical shock incidents in Iraq alone. The memo also indicates the military has begun to inspect all its bathrooms in Iraq. About 20,000 have been examined so far, and nearly 7,000 of them have already been found to have major electrical problems in the showers. And there are at least 65,000 showers still to be inspected. And incredibly, the Defense Contract Management Agency has decided that to fix the 7,000 showers with the electrocution risks, and what could easily be 20,000 more, it will turn to KBR. Dick Cheney's old pals, get billions of taxpayer dollars from a war Dick Cheney helped foment, then Dick Cheney's old pals do a criminally negligent job and they kill some of the soldiers who are not killed in Dick Cheney's phony war. Now, to prevent Dick Cheney's old pals from killing even more Americans in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Pentagon has assigned the urgent, essential, life or death repair work to Dick Cheney's old pals. That's how it works. Welcome to America. All right, let's take a break for just a minute so I can tell you about our two sponsors. Scribd offers unlimited ebooks, unlimited audiobooks from major publishers, and unlimited magazines, all for $9.99 a month. It's a great deal. You can actually sign up for 30 days for free, no charge. Cancel whenever you want if you don't like it. It's an amazing resource. It's a lot cheaper than Audible. They offer unlimited amounts of information here. If you're like me, you geek out with this sort of stuff. To be able to have access to all these audiobooks, regular books, and everything. If you're into conspiracies, if you're into JFK, if you're into aliens or Bigfoot, or, you know, the sinking of the Lusitania, it's all in there. They've got all sorts of information on that. So check out Scribd. If you like it and you sign up for it, it benefits the show directly. We do appreciate that. But also, if you're into that sort of stuff, you're probably, like me, way into documentaries. I geek out. I've seen everything there is to see on Netflix, it seems like. And what's great about CuriosityStream is that you have access to literally thousands of documentaries. Award-winning types, exclusives, originals. You can watch them anywhere. You can cancel your service anytime. It comes in high-definition quality. There's unlimited streaming of thousands of shows. You can stream it on your laptop, your TV, your phone, your tablet. You can even view it offline. It's $19.99 a year or $2.99 a month. That is a small price to pay for acquiring additional information. If you're listening to this podcast, then you are interested in non-traditional information. You're seeking it out. Go take a look at CuriosityStream. The link is in the description box below. You sign up with them, it directly benefits the show. We certainly do appreciate that. Thanks for supporting our show, and thank you for supporting our sponsors as well. The same mentality that allows one to think that electrocution showers are totally normal is the same mentality that makes people think that imposing sanctions on foreign countries is an effective foreign policy strategy. If you want to restrict deliveries of essential goods to countries, you just slap what they call a no-fly zone designation on a region or on a country to prevent airplanes from entering the airspace and thus removing a supply option to the area. So why one thinks they can dictate the comings and goings of airplanes in other countries and airspaces is beyond me. But this is the 21st century version of a roadblock. And you know, of course, you can kill somebody by dropping a bomb on their house, but you can also kill them by restricting their access to medicine, or you can kill someone by preventing them from having food reach their city or their country. The results are the same in the end, of course, but the perception of the crime is very different. People can directly link a bomb blast to a death, but starving an entire country doesn't really have the same, you know, first degree murder direct connection the way that, say, a bomb does. But if you look at what's happened in Yemen because of Saudi Arabia's bombing, in the end, who cares whether they've dropped a bunch of bombs on them that killed people or they starved them out, which killed people? They're dead in the end. It's the same thing. But it's this psychopathic foreign policy mentality that is pervasive in the West, especially. And we feel that we're entitled to make these decisions on foreign countries. And it comes from an arrogance, and it comes from a psychopathy of the people in positions of power, that they think that this is just normal in the way that things are done. And never was it more apparent than during a 1996 interview on 60 Minutes, when Leslie Stahl asked then Secretary of State Madeleine Albright a pretty simple question about the sanctions that they imposed on Iraq the first time around in the early 90s. Her question was, we've heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And, you know, is the price worth it? To which Madeleine Albright replies, I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it. First of all, Madeleine, your membership card to the human race has been revoked, you reprehensible bitch. It's worth it? 500,000 dead Iraqi children is worth what exactly? Destabilizing the region for your buddies in Saudi Arabia and Israel? Stealing their oil? What? What could be worth 500,000 dead children? I mean, Madeleine Albright doesn't care because she's an animal. She's a psychopath of epic proportions. She has no empathy. She has no human emotions. She's a robot. This is completely unforgivable. But it's also not surprising, given her pattern of saying horrible things. And if there was a time when British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook told her, when he was talking about a NATO bombing of Yugoslavia, he said to her that this is illegal under international law. And her response to him was, get some new lawyers. You know what? Go to hell, Madeleine. But whether it's slapping sanctions on countries and thinking nothing of it, or raising $1 billion from strangers and companies to finance your campaign to become president, to get $1 million a year job. I mean, there's something inherently backwards about this system. And one place where people can see it from afar is the revolving door between government and private businesses, and the role of lobbyists in that as well. It gets this whole it gives you this feeling that Washington, D.C. really is a dirty swamp filled with grifters and scumbags, because that's what you see over and over again. Nobody came up with this designation, this description of Washington, D.C. as being a swamp for, they didn't just pull it out of their ass. This is because it's a disgusting place to be, and you feel that once you're in it, you have a hard time trying to get yourself out of it, and there's creatures surrounding you. It's hard to tell where they are, but they're coming for you. And there's really a tradition, I guess is the best way to put it, in Washington, D.C., where those in high public office leave a powerful but, low-paying government job in order to move into the private sector and collect some big paychecks. And on the surface, there isn't anything really wrong with that, but it could look like a conflict of interest. And then you get guys like Eric Holder. And Eric Holder used to work for a law firm called Covington & Burling. And he left that to go do 6 years in the Obama administration as the attorney general before heading back there after he was out of the administration, going back to Covington & Burling. And collecting a massive paycheck again. And why was he why was he collecting that paycheck? Well, Covington & Burling is a firm that represents the biggest banks on Wall Street, the same big banks that Eric Holder refused to prosecute. You know, it's pretty convenient that he's returning to his former company and that they're going to be paying him a shit ton of money, or they are paying him that, as a thank you for the work that he did that benefited Covington & Burling while he was the attorney general. He benefited his old firm by not prosecuting their clients, i.e. the big banks, while he was attorney general. Then he's done being attorney general. He goes back to Covington & Burling and gets a gigantic paycheck from that. And I'm sure he does nothing. I mean, it's not like he's sitting there, you know, researching cases all day long. I'm sure he's paid, you know, $7 or $8 million bucks a year to play golf with his buddies on Wall Street and use that influence. But it wasn't just him. Margaret Richardson, who was Eric Holder's chief of staff. She also left the Justice Department to go to Covington & Burling. Lanny Brewer, same thing, former Department of Justice criminal defense chief. He's back at Covington & Burling as well. We're on a $4 million a year salary. I'm sure he's worth every penny of it. I mean, unless that guy can hit a split finger fastball, he shouldn't be making $4 million doing anything. But that's just, that's normal, unfortunately. This is the way the game has been played. This is what happens when you introduce massive sums of money and the lobbying industry and government, which controls the purse strings, and guys like Eric Holder, who become the attorney general, who's in charge of deciding who gets prosecuted and who doesn't. I mean, the fact that he decided that he wasn't going to prosecute the big banks for their rampant fraud is a clear indicator that he's guilty of rampant fraud, right? I mean, you can't turn your head. You might be, you know, if you catch some guy shoplifting, and the guy might say, "Oh, you know, I put it in my pocket. I was going to pay for it later." Maybe he was telling the truth, and maybe he wasn't. But when you're talking about the big banks and what they did, Goldman Sachs, you know, with their Abacus deal, where they're putting together investment vehicles, selling it to their clients, and then betting against it and getting caught in emails talking about how they're betting on this dog shit, betting against this dog shit Abacus deal. This is a problem, right? There's fraud, rampant fraud. You could swing a dead cat in Washington, at Wall Street, and hit a banker that's guilty of fraud. I mean, it's everywhere. It's an epidemic there. And yet, what, he couldn't find anybody to prosecute? I mean, this is the problem, of course. He's paid to not understand the situation. He's paid to look the other way. It's an implied payout. It's the same sort of payout that presidents get, right? Where they go out and get $500,000 to do, you know, speak at a bank in Russia, like Bill Clinton did, or you get $400,000 to give a speech to Goldman Sachs like Obama did. What are they talking about? Doesn't matter. They're not talking about anything. That's not what it's about. It's not about hearing what they have to say at these speeches. It's about a legalized form of bribery. This is thank you for not screwing us while you were in office. Thank you for taking us off the sanction list. Thank you for having your wife, who is Secretary of State, take this Russian bank off of the terrorist watch list and the sanctions list. This happens all the time. This is how it's done. And this is why people hate Washington. And, you know, over time, these lobbyists found that they had way more influence than perhaps they originally believed. And these elected officials would lean on them for information. And once that started to happen, you know, people took notice. If you couldn't get to the politician directly to pitch your service or your product or whatever, perhaps you could get to the trusted lobbyist and have that person present your idea, product, or service, or whatever. And that influence does come at a cost. And thus, the lobbying industry was created. So, when a politician runs for office, that, or seeks re-election, that process requires money. the bigger and more important the position, the more money the election campaign costs. And candidates seek to, you know, raise money from citizens to fund their campaigns. But there's only so many, you know, there's only so much money a citizen can give. I think they capped it like $2,600. But corporations, thanks to Citizens United, can donate as much as they want. So if you're just prioritizing your fundraising as a politician, you can either get $2,600 at a time from a bunch of small people, or you can hit up a big bank that's got, you know, tons of cash and in need of, you know, some easing of regulations against them. And you can hit them up and they'll give you as much money as you need all at once. So it's understandable that somebody might bypass going to the people for money and going straight to the large corporations, because you just don't have to work quite as hard to do it. So that's part of that. That's why it happens. And then you've got these political action groups, PACs, and this creates a massive conflict of interest, you know, because it's clear that money can be obviously exchanged for power and influence and whatever. And so what you find is that you've got money flowing in from big businesses directly to politicians' campaigns, and then you've got money from the same companies flowing into lobbyist firms and having them hit the politicians from that side too. So they're getting it from every angle. And so what you've got, or what happens, is over the course of a decade, you wind up with situations where General Electric has spent $134 million on lobbying, and where AT&T has spent $91 million on it, and Boeing has spent $90 million, and Northrop Grumman has spent $87 million on it, and Comcast has spent $87 million, and Verizon has spent $87 million. I mean, this is not an insubstantial chunk of money. This is a whole lot of money. And what are they paying for? What are you buying with that? You're not buying a product, you're buying influence. And that's hard to quantify because it's not a tangible thing. But the money matters, and the money does buy influence, because the people that they give it to know how to spend it the right way. And look, it's just a simple accounting question here. When Northrop Grumman spends $87 million over 10 years on lobbying, and they see their sales increase from $5.2 billion to $11.1 billion, then what you realize is that that's the best money they ever spent. It really, research and development, yeah, you got to spend money on that. There's no doubt. But lobbying, boy, you get multiples of your money back in return. It is a fantastic investment for these large companies. Lockheed Martin spent $78 million on lobbying over the course of a decade. They watched their sales increase from $14.7 billion to $21.9 billion. They made $7 billion more for $78 million. Would you spend $78 million to make $7 billion? Absolutely. Now, is it directly tied to it? I mean, can you? No, but when you're Lockheed Martin and your only customer, for the most part, are governments, and the U.S. government in particular, then that's just the cost of doing business, you know, and that's just kind of the way Washington is now set up. So, you know, we keep wondering why we're not getting representation. Well, if you don't have money to pay for politicians, then you're really at the mercy of just hoping that somebody who does have money is paying a politician, and they happen to also want the same things that you want, which is rare. But if that's not the case, if you want something different than the rich guy down the street who's paying that politician, well, then you're shit out of luck, because that guy's going to get what he wants before you get what you want, because he's giving them money. And that's just the facts, and that's just the way it works. And it's dirty, and it's unfortunate, but it's reality. And until the money gets pulled out of politics, until money is removed from lobbying, until they stop this insanity of having an election cycle that lasts 18 months instead of, you know, what really should be maybe 3 or 4 months, nothing's going to change. And that's where we find ourselves, and we scratch our heads and go, God, why is this country so screwed up? Well, it's screwed up because the way the system is set up, the way the rules of the game are now set up, it's a rigged game. It's like going to the county fair, trying to sink basketball shots at that hoop and wondering why it won't go in. Because they've monkeyed with the rim, right? They've rigged it in a way so that you don't always win the big stuffed animal. Lockheed Martin always wins the big stuffed animal because they got the money and they know the guy that's running the game. And that's just the way it works. So what do you call this situation when you have a combination of government and private businesses working arm in arm to take advantage of the public? I mean, is that fascism? Is it corporatism? Fascism is when the state and big business work together for the benefit of the state. Corporatism is when the government and big business work together for the benefit of the corporations. I would say that we have slipped into corporatism, and it's tempting to say, everyone wants to say that it's fascism, but I think we see the way that the big corporations are treated, the way they have, you know, they pay no taxes and they get incredible breaks and they find regulations removed from them. It's because it's benefiting these corporations so much, I tend to lean more towards corporatism. But there's another word for this. There's another word for an entrenched government apparatus that is controlled by a combination of these big evil corporate interests and corrupt government interests, and that's called the deep state. It's a term that Peter Dale Scott coined, and it sticks. Maybe another term for it is the permanent state. You know, I've heard that thrown around. But this is not, it's not new. It's also the octopus that I talk about. It's the title of my book, The Octopus of Global Control, is part of this. It's this deep state. It's this sprawling tentacles. And it's been in operation for over a century here. In fact, Woodrow Wilson mentioned this in 1913. By the way, if you've got your fantasy president pool, right? You want to rank them in terms of who was the worst president of all times. I'm going to put Woodrow Wilson up in the top 5 for sure, maybe even top 3, because under his guidance, the United States brought forth the Federal Reserve and the Internal Revenue Service in 1913, two of the most destructive organizations in the history of this country. And they were both done by him because he was obviously controlled. He was a deeply flawed human being, and he was controlled by the bankers. But one of the things he said was, "Since I entered politics, I have chiefly had men's views confided to me privately. Some of the biggest men in the United States in the field of commerce and manufacture are afraid of somebody, are afraid of something. They know that there is a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it." So he's talking about the deep state. He's talking about the octopus. He's talking about this consortium of big business owners intertwined with the government. Daniel Inouye, who's a United States Senator from Hawaii, talked about this during the Iran-Contra hearings, and I think it was 1986. Yeah, he said, "There exists a shadowy government with its own air force, its own navy, its own fundraising mechanisms, and the ability to pursue its own ideas of national interest, free from all checks and balances and free from the law itself." I mean, that sounds like the plot of a shitty Nicolas Cage movie to me, but this is real. And this is what he's talking about. John Calhoun, former vice president, a power has risen up in the government greater than the people themselves, consisting of many and various and powerful interests combined into one mass and held together by the cohesive power and the vast surplus in the banks. This is what we're talking about. This is the psychosis of government, that when you get a government, it like a moth to the flame, it attracts psychopaths seeking power and money and control. And they get it. And they all come together. The government gives these big business interests what they need. These big business interests give them the money that they need to stay in power. And they want to keep this gravy train going so nothing changes. That's the problem. People talk about how the system's broken. The system is broken to us from the outside. We see it as being defunct, defective. But they see the system as working exactly as it was intended to work. That the system is set up in a way to benefit those at the top at the expense of everybody else. So when we say that the system is broken, it's actually an incorrect statement. The system is working just fine. It's working exactly the way it was designed. The problem is with the design of it. It was designed to benefit a very small percentage. It was designed to benefit the tip top of the pyramid that we see everywhere. And this deep state is a parallel secret government. It is organized by a covert faction of the intelligence agencies. It is operated by a splinter cell of the United States military industrial complex. It's financed through both the major banks, the sale of illegal drugs, the sale of weapons, human trafficking, the sale of people, through the sale of organ harvesting. They are international in their reach. They owe no allegiance to any particular country. This is not a United States specific problem. This is global. They are unbelievably ruthless, and they will protect their interests. This is the deep state. This is what they're talking about. Doug Casey, a financial analyst, has a good quote about this. He says, the deep state is an extremely powerful network that controls nearly everything around you. You won't read about it in the news because it controls the news. Politicians won't talk about it publicly. That would be like a mobster discussing murder and robbery on the 6 o'clock news. You could say the deep state is hidden, but it's only hidden in plain sight. So we can think of this deep state as a mix of the most devious and criminal aspects of several different industries: governmental, military-industrial complex, banking, pharmaceutical, entertainment, international trade, oil and gas, multinational engineering. You know, these are the industries, and it's kind of like a all-star team of scumbags and psychopaths, without the dunk contest, you know, that all with like a very specialized role within this organization. And it's not to say that everyone in these industries is in on it, cause they're not, or even that everyone inside a particular company is in on it, because they're not. You know, when we talk about places like Google and Facebook and, you know, these companies, not everybody that works there is trying to silence dissent. Not everybody that works there is part of this plan. It doesn't work that way. It's only people at the very top. It's people at a very select group. You know, they find and compromise important people within specific companies, and quietly draw them into the organization. This is why you will see this is okay. So Bilderberg is a perfect example of the deep state. Council on Foreign Relations is a perfect example of the deep state. Council on Foreign Relations has like 5,000 members, right? But they're from all over the place, different industries, a lot of them from the media, people that you recognize on your nightly news. They're all CFR members. And not all of them are bad, but it would be probably best to, if someone has a CFR tag next to their name, to at least keep an eye on them because they may be up to no good. Bilderberg, different story with that. You can go ahead and put everybody on the Bilderberg list. You can go ahead and classify them as deep state. You might be wrong about one or two, but whatever. That's a good place to look. The roll call for that event, for those events, those are the people that are in positions of real power. Forget the politicians. Forget that. They're figureheads. Bilderberg's where it's at. That's where you get David Rockefeller thanking the media for 40 years of silence so that they could put forth a one world government. That's where the plan is formulated. That's where presidents are selected. You've got a hybrid of that. Of that with Bohemian Grove. That's more of an occultist pedophile group that takes place in Northern California. It has been going on for a long, long time. It lasts like a couple of weeks, I think. That's where Ronald Reagan was decided to that he would become governor of California was during Bohemian Grove. That's where Alex Jones snuck in. Hey, listen, I mean, Alex Jones, man, he goes off the deep end, of course, but you got to give him credit for that Bohemian Grove sneaking in hidden footage, because that the burning of Moloch and all the crazy shit that they're up to there, that is a fascinating look at what goes on behind closed doors. And I know it's easy to sort of dismiss all this as conspiracy, you know, psychosis or something, that a bunch of powerful, wealthy politicians and businessmen are wearing togas and going out into the forest and, you know, carrying torches and praying to Moloch and all that stuff. It all sounds like science fiction or anything. Hey, I get it, but it's real. And this is part of what they do. You know, this sort of thing matters to them. The glue that keeps these organizations tied together is the darkest form of control there is, and that is pedophilia, control through pedophilia. And it's prevalent through the Bilderberg Trilateral Commission, CFR, Committee of 300, Club of Rome, Tavistock Institute. These organizations, these think tanks and groups that work together to set this agenda for the world are not run by the people that you would want to set the agenda for the world. If you had to pick somebody, it wouldn't be Zbigniew Brzezinski. You know, it wouldn't be Lyndon Johnson. It wouldn't be George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton or John Podesta, or any of these guys. You wouldn't put that, they wouldn't be on your list. But they're who's running this. And they are in a club that you and I are not in, as George Carlin says, but it is a much deeper and darker club than even he probably imagined. And that is when you get into the role of guys like Jeffrey Epstein and the sexual blackmail, brownstone operations that they're running. This is part of the glue that holds all of these people together. You can catch a guy cheating on his wife and use that to blackmail him, but that'll only go so far. You can catch a guy that's closeted and threaten to out him if he doesn't play ball. But that only goes so far too, especially in this society, especially when you've got 6'4" transsexuals reading story time to kindergartners now. What are you going to out some guy for being gay? It like doesn't even matter anymore. Who cares? But the pedophilia component of it, there's no expiration date on that. It never goes away. There's no There's no way to sugarcoat that. There's no way to make it okay with people. And that is what has connected these guys. You can find an interview with a guy named Ronald Bernard, who's a Dutch banker, and he had an emotional breakdown because he was asked to do something that he was uncomfortable, unwilling, maybe even incapable of doing in order to establish himself even further in this banking consortium that he was a part of. And it had to do with harming a child, and he couldn't do it, and he had a breakdown, and he's talked about it openly in these videos. And it's haunting, and it'll make your skin crawl, and it'll make you want to throw up, but it's worth watching to see the reaction on his face, because that's a guy you can tell is not faking it. He's telling you what happens. He's telling you what the initiation ritual is to get into the deep state. And it is, it's where you have to cross a bridge and burn your boat, essentially. There's no coming back from that. And they have you documented doing it. And so then you become part of them. And you can never break free of that. Blood in, blood out, just like a gang. You want out of this club? Well, then you'll be a banker suicide. You know what I mean? Thrown off a building somewhere. Oh, isn't that a shame? But that's how this works. It starts with the psychosis of government. It's not limited to the United States. It happens everywhere. And it's the darkest aspect of the book that I wrote. And if you're interested in finding more about the book, buying the book, you can go to my website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. The digital version of the book is available there. Donate more than $10 to my PayPal account. I'll send you two versions of it. One is an EPUB for e-readers. The other is a PDF. I'll send it to you. I encourage you to share it with your friends and family. Spread the word. If you're old school and you like a tangible paperback book, it's available at barnesandnoble.com and also on Amazon. Hopefully, by making people aware of this, of these control structures, we can get the word out and take away some of their power. For so long, they've had control over us because we didn't know how the game was played. Hell, we didn't even know there was a game being played. But it's time for us to take some responsibility for our own actions, to wake up to the reality of this situation, acknowledge it, the dirty part of it, the way our governments are set up. And once we understand how they work, then we can begin the process to dismantle them and replace them with something that actually represents us. Thanks a lot. Take care, everybody.